The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
For 8 years, Game of Thrones was a critical darling and a huge ratings bonanza for HBO. And by the time it ended, in May, it was the most talked about show on television, or it certainly seemed that way. Not even 6 months later, HBO has just launched a new show based on a series of beloved fantasy novels. But this one, it's got a lot less nudity and not quite as much beheading. The show is called His Dark Materials, and it's based on a trilogy of books, young adult novels, by the writer Philip Pullman.
What in the world?
This is Lyra and Pantalaimon.
Azrael.
I hereby invoke the privilege of Scholastic Sanctuary.
Scholastic and among the many fans sanctuary of those books is the New Yorker's Katie Waldman.
His Dark Materials was first published in the mid-90s, and that leads to an easy comparison with J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books. But Philip Pullman's concerns are very different from hers. His Dark Materials is set in a world parallel to ours and actually occasionally blends into our own world. It stars a sprightly, spunky heroine named Lyra. She has mysterious and unknowable parents. The universe is sort of a patchwork of different fantastical locations and settings. There's kind of a northern sublime world that is populated by armored bears. There are witches. There's a steampunk team of scientists. It's really wonderful. So while HBO is releasing this series based on His Dark Materials, Philip Pullman has just put out a new book set in Lyra's world, and that's called The Secret Commonwealth. So this is the second book of his second trilogy. So if you're counting, that's 5 books set in this universe as of now.
Katie Waldman spoke recently with Philip Pullman, who is at home in Oxford.
So to start off, the HBO-BBC adaptation of His Dark Materials just started airing. You're an executive producer on that show. And back in 2007, there was a film adaptation of the same book, of The Golden Compass, the first book of His Dark Materials. I wonder whether you think that there are any aspects of your work that TV as a medium is particularly well-suited to capture.
Well, I think the human drama is going to come out well, partly because of the quality of the actors who are going to have to present it. TV works a little better in close-up, I think, than the big movie screen does. So it'll be the human drama that works very well. I'm happy that the story will be told fully in this form, whereas it couldn't have been told fully on the stage or on the movie screen.
Yeah. There actually will be listeners, though, who are not familiar with the universe of The Dark Materials. And so just to back up a little bit, it's set in a parallel universe to ours. And the biggest difference is that everyone's soul is manifested in an animal that they can talk with and that everyone else can see. And those animals are called demons, right? Is that the correct pronunciation?
That's right. Yeah. Yes, in Lyra's world, Lyra is the main protagonist. She's a girl of about 11 or 12. In Lyra's world, everybody has a demon, which is their own part of an aspect of their own self, which is in the form of an animal, and it's outside them so that they can, their demon can talk to them, can look around corners when they wait in the shadows, that sort of thing. And the relationship between the human and the demon is a very, very close one, and it can't be broken unless by exceptional force or cruelty or something like that. Is the whole story, the arc of the whole story, is really, I suppose, in one simple sentence about the change from innocence to experience, or the change from childhood to growing up. And the demon symbolizes this because children's demons can change shape all the time. According to what they're feeling or what their mood is or how excited they are or whatever. Whereas in adolescence, the power to change gradually fades away and they find one fixed form which they have for the rest of the their human companion's life. It was a very good idea, probably the best idea I've ever had.
Yeah. A person's demon is their opposite gender, right?
Well, most of them are. There seem to be a few exceptions, but there are all sorts of things I haven't yet discovered about demons. I often get asked, for example, how demons are born. And my answer is, well, I haven't had to describe a scene in which that happens, so I haven't had to think about it yet. Demon gynecology is a mystery to me.
Can you imagine a world of sort of gender fluidity where demons change according to their partner's gender?
Yeah, I can imagine it, but I haven't had to yet. maybe that'll happen in the third book. Maybe you give me an idea that on which the whole story will turn.
So Lyra is what in the States we would call a middle school age student. And I think you taught that age group before you became a professional novelist, right?
Yeah, it was. I taught for about 12 years, and it was children of that age, children between 9 and 13. I taught the sort of 11, 12, 13-year-olds. It's a very interesting age because they are just on the cusp of becoming entering their adolescence. And all sorts of things are opening out for them. And it's wonderful to see that happening to young children. My own grandchildren are going through that stage at the moment. And again, it's very exciting to see.
Your father was a pilot, correct? And he...
That's right, yeah.
You grew up thinking that he had died in battle?
Yeah. When I was about 7 years old in 1953 or 4, the British were fighting an insurgency, as they called it, in Kenya, the Mau Mau insurgency. And the roots of that lay deep in colonialist history, and it's a thing on which we certainly now in Britain cannot look back with pride. But my father was a pilot, and he was involved in that whole distasteful business, and his plane crashed and he died. I was very young, as at the time I said, I was 6 or 7, and I was either led to believe or came to believe or misunderstood, but I thought he'd been shot down in battle, you see. And so to me, he was a great hero, and it wasn't until much, much later that I realized what he'd really been doing, which was effectively dropping bombs on people who had spears. Well, that complicated the whole thing. And then I discovered other things about his life and about his relations with my mother, which I didn't know about. And it caused me to revise my ideas about a lot of things.
Yeah. Would you characterize that as an innocence lost?
Innocence? Oh, I suppose it was in a sense because... Yeah, my eyes were opened. Yes.
I mean, the reason I ask, it just seems that Lyra has a similar experience in the books where she starts out entranced by her father and also her mother, even though they've kept their distance from her. And then over the course of the story, she discovers that there are aspects of them that are less savory and she decides to strike her own path.
That's right, yeah. This is a classic trope, if that's the word I want, in literature that children read, because the first thing you have to do if you're writing a story is to get the parents out of the way. There can be no adventure in a story if the parents are saying, "No, come on, dear, it's bedtime." So you have to get rid of the parents pretty quickly. And that's what happens in this one, of course, as in Treasure Island, as in all sorts of classic children's books.
Yeah. I'd love to actually turn to the Secret Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what drove you to continue the story? I mean, you actually placed the first volume of The Book of Dust in the past, before the events of His Dark Materials, but the second one is after. What drew you back to the world?
Well, I hadn't said enough, at least I hadn't discovered enough in His Dark Materials about dust. Dust with a capital D, this mysterious substance, essence, whatever it is, that seems to pervade the universe, and which in the story, in our universe, is called dark matter. Dark matter is a phrase that fits very well with the line I took from Paradise Lost that gave me His Dark Materials. Dark matter is this invisible, intangible something that holds the universe from together, stops it from flying apart. Its mass is such that gravity doesn't let us escape from it. But we don't know what it is. When I was writing His Dark Materials, 25 years ago or more, scientists hadn't yet discovered what dark matter was, and I kept my fingers crossed that they wouldn't before I finished the book. Fortunately, they still haven't. So the universe is still a very mysterious place.
Yeah, and there's also a kind of maturation of the themes of the earlier trilogy. So Lyra and her demon Pan actually part ways, and Pan appears to be searching for Lyra's lost imagination.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. She's 20. She's an undergraduate. She's a reader, and she's read some books which have influenced her a great deal, but books by two prominent intellectuals of her time and her world. One of them is a fierce rationalist who denies the existence of anything remotely irrational. And the other is a kind of postmodernist who believes that there's nothing, no such thing as truth anyway, and it's all whatever we care to believe. And these people have seriously undermined her security, her intellectual security. And Pan thinks it's because they've stolen her imagination, and he goes off to look for it.
I have so many questions about this. The first is the idea that the demons are merely psychological projections of what is happening internally.
Yeah. This is what one of the philosophers says.
It does bear a certain resemblance to cultural analysis that has been generated around your own work. And I wonder if this is you trying to engage those arguments within the world of the book itself.
I suppose it is, yeah. I suppose it is. These two different philosophers or intellectuals, they represent strands of thought that are current in the world at the moment, with which I profoundly disagree. The first one, the guy, a German called Gottfried Brander, is this fierce rationalist who believes that the only kind of evidence that's worth having is scientific evidence. Nothing else is of any use at all, and he regards the imagination, the world of art, poetry, etc., with a fierce contempt. I presented this as being a very persuasive argument, which has influenced a lot of young people in Lara's world, including her.
Yeah, in the first trilogy, you describe Lyra as a wonderful liar with a poor imagination. Do you see a sort of tension there?
Yeah. Now, I didn't know why I said that at the time. I'm beginning to see it now. Her imagination is all in Pan, of course. Is all in her demon. And it's this lack of connection which sets the story going, I think, in the Secret Commonwealth.
I mean, it's lovely that the conceit of the demon allows you to posit sort of a vision of selfhood as a dialogue between different parts of the self, you know, that there's always multiplicity.
Yeah, that too. I mean, to be more accurate, I suppose I should have about 10,000 demons for each human being, because we don't consist of just two parts, but two is quite enough to manage in the story.
Yeah. I'd love to go back for a second to Lyra and Pan's, so to speak, conscious uncoupling.
Lyra as Gwyneth Paltrow and Pan as whatever her husband's name was.
Oh, goodness.
That's very funny. Conscious uncoupling. Oh, yeah.
Were you consciously sort of framing a metaphor for our adult struggles to use our imaginations?
But mainly I was concerned to see what had caused it and what was going to happen as a result and how they were going to find each other again. Mm-hmm. You don't realise all the metaphorical or implications of what you're writing or telling when you're telling a story. It's sometimes best if you don't spell them out and for readers to pick them up for themselves. And sometimes they have a better explanation than you do. And of course, if they come up with an explanation that is creditable, I'm happy to claim responsibility for it. But we don't always know what we're doing when we're telling a story.
The novelist Philip Pullman. He spoke with The New Yorker's Katie Waldman. The adaptation of His Dark Materials has just come out on HBO, and Pullman's new book is called The Secret Commonwealth.